Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan, and on today's show we're settling down in front of the small screen to discuss some of the more recent releases from Netflix and Amazon Prime. I'll be chatting with writer Lucy Jones and TV editor for London Live Toby Earle to round up some of this month's series. Plus, we'll be heading over to Sao Paulo for a slice of Japanese culture, and we'll be counting down the Belgian charts in this week's Global Countdown. That's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. I'm joined in the studio by Lucy Jones and Toby Earle. Welcome both. Now, as all Netflix subscribers will know by now, the fifth series of House of Cards was released by the streaming giant last week, and this season we meet Frank and Claire Underwood as they battle to retake the presidency against Republican leader Will Conway. Let's hear a clip.
I demand that this Congress declare a state of war has existed and does exist between ICO and the United States of America. And I demand that every member of this House stay in this chamber for as long as it takes until you bring my request to a vote, or you will all go down in history as cowards. Cowards! Madam Speaker, I repeat, I demand a vote. I will not yield. I will not yield. I will not yield.
Such a dramatic scene there to open season 5 of House of Cards. I mean, it's one of the best things about House of Cards, isn't it? That it's not afraid to be a little bit ridiculous. Toby, what did you find about the opening, at least, of this latest season?
Well, it's kind of surprising to hear a US president speaking complete sentences and with with words more than one syllable. I think Series 5, for me, has quite a lot of work to do in regaining some of the viewers' trust. I personally found Series 4 a bit of a turn-off. I've been a very big fan of the show, but I found Series 4 had really not only lost its way in terms of its sort of motifs with regards to the kind of asides to camera, which sort of marked it out as a quite unique piece, but also the plotting. It felt very flabby. And I dare I say, in this political environment, a little bit ridiculous. I mean, how wrong I am now.
Well, I know it's one of the many things that we're afraid of when American politics did in reality get a little bit crazy was that House of Cards might be rendered redundant. Lucy, one of the biggest fears I have for a television series that I'm in love with is when it starts to feel as though it's all being made up as people go along. I like to get a feeling that everything's been very well planned. Where are you on that scale?
Well, I think what you just said is exactly the kind of diagnosis of House of Cards where it is now. It's jumped the shark, but not really because of anything that's happening kind of in the storyline, but because what's happening in real life has kind of caught up with it. So the idea of Kevin Spacey's Frank Underwood becoming president, working his way through political manoeuvres and machinations in such a brilliant, scheming way just seems so kind of absurd and unlikely. But because of what's happening in real life, it almost feels a bit dated. And in this Series 5, there are obvious parallels with what's happening in real life. The NSA is quite a big part of it. The relationship with Russia, ICO, who are the terrorist group, who are supposed to be ISIS. And it just feels like, I mean, I feel sorry for the showrunner and the writers. It might have been that they actually kind of planned all these things, or, you know, in the writer's room, but they just seem to be a step behind almost what's happening in real life. And also, I think with the way the show is filmed, the structure and the form of it are quite traditional, apart from, as you mentioned, you know, breaking the fourth wall and talking to camera. It's all in the White House. It's all very kind of political. There's no interesting flashbacks or episodes that focus on one character. There's no kind of creative tampering with kind of the form of television. It feels quite trad. And that is why I'm personally finding Series 4 a bit of a slog.
So I'm
5, sorry.
Indeed. It's hard to keep track because it does feel as though it's been around for a while now. I'm only up to episode 5 of season 5, so there's still a little way to go. I am hoping that some of the previously explored storylines will start to come back, because there is always this hint that maybe some of the things that we've seen happen will come back and haunt President Underwood, but so far that's never really exploded in a way that wraps the whole series up into one. And perhaps that is because Netflix are a little bit of afraid of the series feeling as though it's come to an absolute end. They want to keep it going, so on and so on and so on. Toby, do you think maybe there needs to come a time when Netflix makes the decision, okay, we're going to wrap this up, we're going to put a bookend on this storyline and not always leave these threads dangling in the wind?
Well, I think with particularly with House of Cards, I mean, very early on in its life on Netflix, you had here a politician who was prepared to commit murder and murder someone with whom he is romantically linked and is, you know, is intimate with. So right from the off, this guy is out of control. And he's a sociopath, a psychopath. Now, there were we felt, you know, during the sort of the evolution of the series that you had the reporters on his trail, you had these stories, these threads that they were picking up, and they were cut ruthlessly down one by one to the point where in the last series you had the former high-flying journalist being gunned down after he tries to shoot the president. Now, you kind of think that whatever bars were closing in on Frank Underwood have just fallen to the ground and that there is no cage in sight for him, which of course poses a problem because you think, I mean, really? You know, there seems to be such a wealth of delinquency within his terms of office. Sooner or later, someone would Woodward and Bernstein him pretty good. Mm. And so will they have to pull the plug on it sooner or later? Of course, absolutely. Does it feel like it could have come sooner? Maybe. But, you know, it's a piece of television for them that is the vanguard of their invasion into traditional television and has been nominated for multiple awards, won multiple awards. It is. It carries the flag for Netflix, and it will take, I think, quite a lot for them to ask the writers and the stars to lay that flag down.
Lucy, as you mentioned, it does. Maybe one of the problems is that it is feeling a little bit dated simply because of what's happening in real life. Who knows? Maybe they're waiting to see what James Comey says this week before they decide what form the next season will take. But do you think perhaps they're kind of just, the producers, the writers, maybe they're just a little bit undecided on what it will be that eventually takes Frank Underwood down, because essentially they need to come to a decision. What is it going to be that ends his political career? Is it going to be someone else coming in and Underwooding him and, you know, manoeuvring their own way to the presidency and eating away at him using his own bait? Or is it going to be, as Toby says, is he going to be Woodward and Bernstein? Will it be truth and justice, or will it be the dirty world of politics that takes him down? Maybe they're just waiting to see what happens in the real White House before they decide what's going to happen in the fictional one.
Well, I think this series is positioning Tom Hammerstein and the Washington Herald, the kind of the main journalist who's digging into Zoe Balfour's murder, as the person who's going to kind of rip off the mask of Frank Underwood. I did read that apparently this series, believe it or not, is also based on quite, you know, the original House of Cards series was based on a book, and the writer of that book wrote other books as well around kind of satellite books, and apparently it is based on kind of those deeper kind of character studies of this Prime Minister subject as it is originally. So I wonder how that's going to play. I mean, I think that, as Toby says, these threads that are left lingering, the Zoe thread, the Lucas thread, you know, they've got to be tied up. I just want to see Frank Underwood get done for Zoe's death. I find that the most interesting part of the story. When it tries to go into kind of West Wing moving parts, lots of characters, kind of the political wonkery, I think that's less interesting. It's really Frank Underwood's kind of psychopathy, which is really interesting, and of course his relationship with Claire. You haven't seen the whole thing, so I won't reveal any spoilers, but it does get a bit more interesting in this series. And I think at the end, Claire rises up even more so as she has in the past, so perhaps she will be the one who undoes Underwood.
Well, my money's on Claire Underwood turning into something else that she hasn't quite fully formed into just yet. She seems to be being developed as some sort of antithesis to the Hillary Clinton-style First Lady, aspiring to be something else, but in a much darker way.
Well, I reckon they thought Hillary would win, probably.
Well, indeed.
It would be very much of a different watch if that had happened.
Yes. And that's really thrown a lot of television off kilter. There was the spin-off to The Good Wife that was completely thrown because that was all set to premiere right after the victory of Hillary Clinton, which never took place. But that is a story for another day. House of Cards is available on Netflix right now. But now we need to flick over to Amazon, where the brand new series I Love Dick is now streaming. Toby, I know you've been watching this one. Perhaps set up the storyline for us to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, first off, let's be clear here. I mean, it's a bit pretty provocative title. There is a character in it called Dick. So let's not sort of assume anything else. This is based on a novel by Chris Krauss, and it's been developed by Jill Soloway, who brought Transparent to Amazon to widespread, enormous acclaim, which starred Jeffrey Tambor as a man who presents himself to his children. Actually, I'm transgender, and that has won all sorts of plaudits, and it's beautifully done. This is, like I say, the adaptation of Chris Krauss's novel about a couple who end up in a small town in Texas. They're New York types. They're artsy. They're kind of, you know, they're these city guys. They're used to the kind of high life and whatnot. And they end up in this small town in Texas, and they kind of end up marooned there. And the woman, in particular, played by Catherine Hahn, she's this filmmaker. She's meant to be going to Venice to premiere this film. The film doesn't get picked up in Venice, so she's stuck in Murtha in Texas, where she meets this guy, this kind of mythical art lecturer called Dick, played by Kevin Bacon. And he's this kind of amalgamation of the mythic American cowboy, but also one with the intellectual chops of a West or East Coast visiting professor. I mean, he's a smart guy, like taciturn, rude, but also looks good in a cowboy hat astride a horse. And she falls for him, and she falls for him in a way that is maybe, to many of our ways of thinking, quite dangerous. And she starts writing letters to him, and they are explicit, and they're about everything she'd love to be, to love to do to him, and they are very much about her taking control of this sort of fictional relationship. But then the letters get leaked out into the local town, and people start reading them, and that completely spins everything on its head.
Okay, that is quite the summary. That is quite the summary. Now, I know that a lot of people have been talking about this, though. This show has really taken over a large sector of the internet. Before we go on to it any further, though, let's hear a bit of a clip.
Dear Dick, how did we not know each other before now?
Maybe.
Sorry. Don't be mad at me.
I'm not.
I forgot what lust felt like until I met you.
I don't find you interesting. Not now. Not ever.
Oh, my God.
What are you writing?
Short story disguised as a letter.
Who's your letter to?
Dear Dick.
Game on.
So that was a clip from I Love Dick. Now, the pilot of the show was released last summer. It created a lot of chatter, as I was alluding to just earlier. Lucy, what is it about this that's really resonating with everyone?
Well, I think that Jill Soloway is one of the greatest TV writers and producers that we've had recently. And she's picked up a really interesting story. I mean, Chris Krauss's book's been around for a while, but the love triangle between the three is such that hasn't really been explored in television before. You know, it's a bit of a kind of taboo situation that the woman's kind of in charge, but then the relationship between Catherine Hahn's husband and Kevin Bacon's character is really interesting. So I think it raises kind of a lot of questions about sexuality and relationships that haven't been asked before. I also think Catherine Hahn is incredible. I'd watch anything that she's in. I think she's kind of been a little bit underestimated or under the radar until recently, and she is just, her performance in this is spectacular.
Toby, it feels as though Amazon is, well, I mean, we know Amazon is really aspiring to rise to that caliber of Netflix, and maybe above that as well. They struck up that partnership with Woody Allen a little while ago. Didn't exactly go to plan, but there were certainly the seeds there of aspiring to be something more than just, you know, the Amazon of the internet, a sort of repository of all sorts of kind of weird and wonderful and sometimes horrible things to find on Amazon Prime. This later series from Jill Soloway, it follows on from her previous success with Transparent as well. Do you think we're going to see more and more of these partnerships happening between what you could be described as auteurs of the screen?
Yeah, I mean, I've interviewed Jill Soloway in the past about Transparent, I think you'll hear this from a lot of people who make shows for Amazon, Netflix. They'll talk about the freedom, they'll talk about the creative license that they are empowered with by these companies. They let them go off and make these programs, and I can't imagine really Transparent making it onto any other traditional mainstream platform. I mean, it was a gamble, sure, for Amazon. But I mean, when you cast the likes of Jeffrey Tambor and those others around him, I think you were in pretty safe hands. And as Lucy said, she's one of the greatest writers and producers to emerge in the last few years. Very exciting talent. And this, I think, again shows that Amazon have said to her, look. I mean, if you've watched it, you'll know that Amazon has said to her, go away and make your program. The one you want to make, not the one that executives want to give notes for, not the one that one advertiser's giving you notes for to say, well, can we just maybe cut that bit and slip this bit in because that would be good for the beer adverts. You know, they are leaving her to work in a way that she would like to produce the best piece of art she can. And I think, you know, what we both said, Lisa and I, about the risks again this takes. I mean, it's portrayal of a woman who is the sort of sexually dominant one, who is voracious, who takes charge, who is confident, who's unapologetic. That is, again, entirely refreshing and entirely modern, as it should be.
It feels as though it's part of the business model here is that it's aiming towards an audience that is prepared to pay for something that they very much like and they very much want. Only a few years ago, well, quite a few years ago now, we had a program like Queer as Folk, the American version at least. It was only able to survive by being on a very niche network, Showtime, in the United States, and it went on for a very long time. It was very successful, but if it weren't for that network sort of experimenting with these quite niche shows that they know are only going to appeal to a smaller audience than the mainstream sort of format, then it wouldn't have really have been successful. And I mean, HBO has experimented with a similar thing, but even still, HBO still needs to attract quite a large audience before they can have a program that's really successful and can go on for quite a long time. This particular program, I Love Dick, has attracted the likes of Andrea Arnold on board as a director. She was, of course, the filmmaker behind American Honey, widely pipped to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes last year. Do you think really that's part of it, Lucy, that they know that they can build this show and it will appeal to a smaller audience, but that audience is going to be loyal to it, they're going to download every program, they're going to watch every program, and they're quite happy to pay for it?
I think so, yeah, I think you're right. But also I think it reflects a more general kind of diversity in society that we have at the moment, where, you know, in the kind of world of fake news and kind of propaganda, that there is a real kind of need and appetite for genuine art about all kinds of life experiences. Kind of we're moving away from, I was thinking this actually watching House of Cards a couple of days ago, you know, it was all kind of men in suits, and I was like, God, I haven't actually watched this kind of show for a while. It used to be all I watched, you know. Now there are really interesting, diverse characters on screen. That's kind of gone a bit more mainstream. Kind of taboos are broken, people are really interested in the wider experiences of life. So I think that's probably reflective in society. But also, I mean, I suppose, like as Toby was saying, you know, Transparent was such a hit that they probably thought I Love Dick would be quite a safe bet.
I Love Dick is available right now to watch on Amazon Prime. Now back to Netflix, because we are going to talk about the third and final season of Bloodline. This American drama has followed the secrets of the Rabin family since the return of Danny, the black sheep of the family, in season one. Lucy, give us a brief summary of what's happened so far in the program and where the final season is going to take us.
Okay, so series three. I mean, I suppose the whole show is centered around this slow combustion of the Rayburn family. So this is a very kind of wealthy family who live in the Florida Keys, and their mother, who's played brilliantly by Sissy Spacek, owns an inn. And the elder brother, John Rayburn, is the local detective. The daughter, Meg Rayburn, is a local lawyer. And then the black sheep of the family, Danny Rayburn, played again amazingly by Ben Mendelsohn, turns up out of the blue. Series one, series two kind of unravels a past tragedy that happened. So a daughter, a sister of these siblings, was drowned. Danny was blamed. He was out there on the water, and then he was violently beaten up by his father. They covered up the abuse of Danny, and they said it was a car accident. So all these siblings were told to lie from a very early age, and they lied to the police. And that is kind of the kernel where all the kind of corruption and lies begin. the kind of main climax of what happens in series one is that Danny gets killed by John Rayburn, and it's kind of in a fit of passion and a bit of an accident. But then series three starts with John Rayburn having to clear up the mess. There's other murders that happen afterwards. His partner is killed by his brother, and series three is basically John Rayburn breaking bad, and I think it's amazing. It hasn't been reviewed very well, but, you know, the psychodrama of the whole family, it goes back into their past. There's a lot of flashbacks. There's a quite a bizarre penultimate episode where you don't really know what's real and what's not. And then also you've got the narrative line of a trial. So John Rayburn is effectively framing someone for the murder of his partner to be loyal to his brother. But I suppose the question that is asked is, you know, how far would you go to protect your family? Lots of ambiguity, lots of blurred lines, and lots of kind of emotional intelligence and interests.
We'll assess the way forward for season three in just a moment, but first let's hear a little piece of Bloodline.
I'd like to confess.
We have lost fucking everything.
Please don't judge us. People. But we did a bad thing. When is this gonna end?
Things will work out. They always do.
So that's a piece of Bloodline there. It's of course not really made it big amongst the caliber of other Netflix series, that's certain. Well, Lucy's certainly on board. Toby, why do you think it's not really struck a chord with anyone, especially considering you've got someone like Sissy Spacek at the helm here? She would ordinarily capture a lot of attention.
I think it's not one of those ones that's landed in the same way over here, or internationally, perhaps, as other shows we might discuss. House of Cards, Kimmy Schmidt. I didn't find Bloodlines for me. I found it a little bit kind of 21st century soapy. So as a consequence, I haven't engorged myself upon the three series which are available. And that's just where I am. It's not to say it's not well made and well crafted, of course, because these things tend to be well made and well crafted these days. They have to be, because it's so competitive. If you look like you've drop the ball, if you look a little clunky, then people will immediately spot that and they will kind of think, I could go elsewhere now. I've never really connected with it. I just haven't felt a connection with it. And I don't know if it's because it's about a fairly well-to-do family. It's Miami, right?
Florida Keys.
I don't know if there's a kind of automatic thing of like, I don't know, man, would I rather watch someone going through something in a kind of a grittier environment than some kind of wealthy family going, oh, we've got problems. I've just go on the yacht and have a...
Part of the problem feels like when you describe it on paper, it does feel as though it's just a tense family drama. And even though that may not be the case, even though if you watch it and you are engrossed by it, there might be more on offer here. But part of the attraction of a lot of these dramas is that when you describe them in articles online, in, you know, in magazine reviews and so on, you can actually map out how interesting and unusual this might be. You know, it's a drama set in an advertising agency in the 1960s. Ooh, I've not seen that before. This, on paper, sounds as though it could be kind of like The OC, you know, kind of like something we saw quite a few years ago. Dare I say it, Dawson's Creek. Is that part of the problem, that it doesn't exactly stick out as high caliber premium TV?
It's a fair point, but I think the thing that elevates it above those shows, both of which I love too, are the acting, the characters. So you've got, as I mentioned, Sissy Spacek, but also Carl Chandler and Ben Mendelsohn, who are fantastic. And then in supporting roles, you've got Chloe Sevigny and Andrea Risborough. And they're all really interesting actors to watch, and they all have really in-depth characters. I think one of the things about Series 3 is that it was meant to be six series, so they've had to fit basically four series into series three. So it does feel kind of rushed, but it also has so much going on. There are loads of cliffhangers, and it's not the slow burn than it kind of was in series one and two. So I think, I mean, it is grittier than The OC and Dawson's Creek, and it does explore in depth sibling.
I would have guessed that it's a bit grittier than Dawson's Creek. Yeah. That was perhaps a little bit tongue-in-cheek.
Sure, but it explores sibling rivalry, birth order, loyalty, honesty, corruption, in interesting ways. And I mean, it looks lush, you know. There's lots of rain, there's lots of smoking, there's lots of alligators and rolling waves, and I am for it, but I know that I'm probably in a minority.
Well, that is a shame for Netflix. That will be the final season of Bloodliners. It's out on Netflix right now. Now, finally, we're back on Amazon for a brand new series called American Gods, which has a fairly complex setup. It's based on the 2001 novel by Neil Gaiman. And it's a fantastical series following the mysterious character known as Shadow Moon. Let's listen to a clip.
What's a god?
They're real if you believe in them.
So who are you?
You wouldn't believe in me if I told you.
This is my man, Shadow Moon.
He does not know our world.
I'm easing him in.
You've gotten yourself mixed up in some really weird shit, Shadow. You think I'm spent?
You're as forgotten and as unloved as any of us.
I'm doing just fine.
You're trying to start a war?
We're at war already, and we're losing.
That was a clip from American Gods. Toby, we've spent too much time talking about House of Cards today, so time is short. Quickly run us through the plot for American Gods.
Okay, this will not be for everyone, and I'll put that out there right now, okay, because this is a phantasmagorical version of American history, which presents everything from the first Vikings landing on the shores through to present day, and interweaved through all these disparate sort of footsteps of history, if you can interweave footsteps, and I'm not mixing too many metaphors at once. You have this story of Shadow Moon, this convict who was released from prison. He finds his wife is dead, and he is deeply saddened by that, of course. And sort of in this first day out of prison, when he learns this, he meets a very mysterious chap called, who he then goes on to find is called Mr. Wednesday, and that's played by Ian McShane. They then bond into this kind of partnership. It becomes sort of something like a road movie. But really, this is about battle between the old gods and the new gods. Mr. Wednesday is Odin. He's this old, great, big Norse daddy god. And he is battling against the new gods, the likes of media, technology. So a fairly out there premise, okay? And when I say it's an out there premise, you haven't seen the visuals, because some of the visuals are really pretty trippy. It is splendidly played by Ian McShane, who is, I mean, I would sell my soul to him. I've interviewed him about this, and I've really almost just signed anything he asked me to, and I would have signed myself to him. The cast is incredible. I mean, you have Ricky Whittle playing Shadow Moon, you then have Emily Browning, Crispin Glover, Bruce Langley, and Gillian Anderson, to name but a few. Gillian Anderson plays the god of media. In the second episode, she appears as Lucille Ball on the set of I Love Lucy, talking directly to Shadow Moon's character, and it's all perfectly pitched. She then goes on, you'll see her dressed as David Bowie. So she plays this vast range of characters, and all the time it's sort of talking about American history and the conflict between the old and the new. It's executive produced and creative by Brian Fuller. If you watched Hannibal, if you ever saw the grim fairy tale that was Hannibal, you will recognise his gruesome fingerprints all over this. The colours, the splashes of blood and gore which are smeared across this tale of a man really in the wrong place at the wrong time, trying to make the best of a very bad situation. I hope that's kind of done it some justice, but I mean, it's not going to be for everyone, because it is quite fantastical.
I mean, we are
it to me.
Well, I was going to ask you actually, Lucy, because this is, with that description from Toby, a wonderful description, by the way, we're at the other end of the scale here to how Bloodline is sort of pitched. This is something that I don't think many people would have heard and told via the medium of television before. But with so many details there, it feels as though you would have to open your mouth quite wide to take a bite. Is that going to be a drawback for some people, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, I have been kind of put off it because it looks just a bit kind of, sci-fi is not really for me, and I kind of, I don't, but you've totally convinced me that I should give it a go. But tell me, Toby, do they pull it off?
I mean, it is, there's a lot to digest, you're right. I love the idea of having to write, open your mouth really wide, like some kind of constrictor who's able to kind of like dislocate its jaw, as the kind of old wives' tale says. There is a lot happening in the first episode. So you do have an assault, a sensory assault of images and of ideas. But I am fully on board that kind of programme at the start. You know, if it has to pay off, obviously, you can't just have that for 12 hours, because sooner or later you're just going to think, oh, man, have I just been in a club, like in a tent at Glastonbury or something? What's happened here? It does start to sort of coalesce into a story. But I can completely appreciate that it is visually overwhelming at times, and also people might find it a little thin on plot because of that.
American Gods is out now on Amazon Prime with new episodes available every Sunday. And my thanks to Lucy Jones and Toby Earle for their television reviews today. Now, jetting over to Sao Paulo, Brazil and Japan are separated by more than 17,000 kilometres as the crow flies. Culturally speaking, however, they might be even further apart. But that hasn't stopped leaders in Tokyo from reaching out with an ambitious global initiative. In late April, a new Japan House opened in central Sao Paulo, the first of three sister institutions, with others currently in the pipeline for Los Angeles and London. The idea is to combine art and culture with business and technology all in the same place, with exhibitions, shops, a restaurant, activities, talks, and more. And it hasn't taken long for people to find out, with an average of more than 3,000 visitors streaming into Japan House every day for the last few weeks. Monocle's Frederick Burness sat down with Angela Hirata, the institution's president, to find out what the buzz is all about.
We were set up to spread the word about the Japan that people don't know, the Japan that's new and contemporary, but preserving tradition at the same time. A lot of people don't know about the innovations happening in Japan today, especially here in Brazil. We offer a Japanese concept, but it's adapted to Brazilian culture. You can't just take things from a totally different culture and force them into a country. That's not what Japan House is. The mission is to look for what we can develop together and what we can inspire.
What kind of ideas do you have for trying to stimulate that exchange?
The project is all about finding what we can do together. Otherwise, it's not economically sustainable. The government has given us the tools to start, but in 2 to 3 years they won't invest anymore, so we need to stand on our own 2 feet. Organising a big exhibition, how long can that go on? Yes, you can have the exhibition, but there should also be a business behind it. For example, look at our current show. It's all about bamboo, with historical exhibits and a marvellous art installation. So why not start an interesting business with it? You can have cloth, paper, structures, furniture and more. Japan is a country without very many natural resources, but they find out how to get the most of every raw material they have, like bamboo. Brazil, on the other hand, has such an abundance of produce, iron, metals, precious stones, oil, everything you can imagine. We must combine all these things and link the countries together for a better future.
Thinking about those connections, I'm interested in why the Japanese government picked Brazil to host the South American branch of Japan House, which will eventually cover 5 continents. Sao Paulo itself has a very prominent Japanese community. Do you think that played any part in the decision?
Logicamente, tem sim, muito a ver, porque...
Logically, there's a strong link. I'm a Japanese descendant, and we are the biggest community in the world outside Japan. But something really important is that we are all Brazilians. We are already the second generation. A lot of us know as much about Japan as any other Brazilian. We know about the food, a few common objects that are easy to find, but that's all getting further away. Japan House is here to show that Japan today isn't the same as those things. We respect what our ancestors brought here, but we are not an extension of it. That was a different time. Japan House is bringing contemporary Japan here, and it wasn't created for any particular group. It's for all of Brazilian society.
One of the most popular attractions in the first show at Japan House is a circular cinema with temporary walls made from, you guessed it, bamboo. There's space for about 15 people who lie on their backs to watch a cartoon projected on the ceiling. The ground floor also features a library, exhibition stands, a display area with Japanese gadgets, and a cafe serving green tea with tasty desserts. On the upper levels, you'll find the main exhibition hall, along with a terrace, a shopping area, a conference room, and a restaurant run by renowned chef Junji Sakamoto. My next question for Angela Hirata was about her personal story. How did her family end up in Brazil?
My grandparents originally came here to start business ventures. Their plan was to invest in land and live here for about 10 years, but then World War II started, so they couldn't go back. I came from a very liberal family background. They wanted us to be Brazilian, but never forget our Japanese blood. So we learned about Japanese culture and spoke the language. My grandfather always said that their idea wasn't to leave us with a material heritage. They wanted to give us something which nobody could ever take away, which is culture. I've also never tried to live in a Japanese community. I always wanted something different.
In a sense, we could say that with Japan House, you're actually fulfilling the dreams of your grandparents. It seems like they really wanted you to represent that kind of third culture.
That's really interesting to think about. Brazil is my homeland. The homeland of my parents and grandparents is Japan. I always say that I'm really happy that they came here, as my family might not have survived in Japan because of the war. Like them, I spent a long time working in business, but I never dreamed that I would be invited to create Japan House when I submitted my proposal. There aren't many institutions which do art and business together in this way. It might be the last job of my career, so I want to build a really strong connection between Brazil and Japan, my two countries. I really feel like I've won the lottery with this project.
Thanks to Frederick Bernas for that report. For more information, head to japanhouse.jp. Now, before we leave today, it is time for our global countdown, where we take a look at the music charts of one country around the world. And, of course, we welcome Fernando Augusto Pacheco to the studio. Hello, Fernando. Where are you jetting us off to now?
We're going to stay in Europe. We're going to Belgium.
We're not jetting. We're just jumping on the Eurostar.
Exactly.
That's much easier.
Very quick one. You know, and the Belgians, they do like good food, and apparently they like good music as well, I have to say.
That's good to know.
And of course, you know, Ben, I'm a huge fan of Eurovision. I think you know that as well, Lucy. And it's funny because I think the Belgians loved their entry so much, but I'll stop talking because I'll start with the top five, first of all.
All right, because I've got a sneak peek at the list in front of me here. So the suspense, I have to say, is not hitting me as much as it could, but I have seen what number five is. Oh, not exactly Eurovision, is it?
Well, he's back again, but this time at least not with Shape of You. That's the second track of his album Divide. It's Galway Girl by Ed Sheeran. Again, you know, this the same style, very catchy. And it's interesting that the second single is also doing well in the charts around the world. Not quite like Shape of You, but as you can see, a very respectable number five. I quite like number four as well. I don't know if you guys heard this song by Clean Bandit and Zara Larsson.
Zara Larsson, of course, making a common appearance on Monocle 24. We often play her material.
Absolutely, a rising star from Sweden. She's only about 17 or 18. The song's called Symphony, and what I like about the song is kind of this ballad you can dance to, because of course, there's the electronic bits to it, but then, you know, they play the strings, there's some touches of classical music in it. Maybe that's why the song's called Symphony, in a way. I approve of that track. Number three, we have another duo, unlikely duo, the Chainsmokers and Coldplay with Something Just Like This, and I believe Coldplay were performing the special Manchester concert. They did a quite nice version of this track as well. But number two, that's the main story. Did you guys watch Eurovision this year?
Of course, Fernando. Oh no, you missed it, Lucy.
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it actually wasn't
was
a standout
watching,
one.
I was watching House of Cards
for work reasons, of course.
Yeah. Fernando, I have to say, I don't think Lucy really missed out on much with that rendition, because the last couple of years have been a lot more impressive.
Yes, but I have to say, the Belgian entry was quite nice. I liked the song, even though the performance was quite downbeat. Her name was Blanche with City of Lights. And it's interesting that she's number two, because I have to be honest with you, in a lot of countries, you know, their own Eurovision entries, they don't chart exactly. You know, people like to watch on Eurovision, but, you know, it's not really on the charts. But that song, I think, you know why I believe it's number two? Because it's the kind of music that people are actually listening. It's kind of an indie pop with some touches of tropical house as well. And as I say, as a song, not a performance, I think it works very well. And another thing, I think Belgium, the Belgian performance at Eurovision is like the Belgian performance at the World Cup. They're very well liked, well respected, but they never win. So the song ended in fourth, but I'm very glad to see it's number two here.
Indeed. It's a funny thing about Eurovision. It's what would be successful on the radio doesn't necessarily translate to what would be successful on the stage. It's a funny balancing act. But Fernando, tell us what number one is. And I mean, I'm happy to say it is something we are also playing on Monocle 24 at the moment, and it's really resonating in much of the world, isn't it?
And I like that it's not in English as well. And it will be the song of the summer. I predict this song will be number one for the next 2 or 3 months. Let's play a clip first.
Fernando, it's such a catchy song. It annoys me that I don't speak the language because I can't really sing along to it without sounding like a bit of an idiot.
Well, to be honest, when I've read the lyrics, there's nothing too special about it. You know, it's just, you know, a boy wants to meet a girl. It's called Despacito, of course, by the Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee as well. And there's a version with Justin Bieber for those, you know, who want some English in the song. But I think the Belgian version is the proper one without Justin Bieber. And I have to say, it's number one in the US as well. That's
it's impressive. In the US,
it's
the Justin Bieber version, one would imagine.
The Justin Bieber one,
right? Yeah.
But still, for a song sang in Spanish, that's very, very rare to reach number one in the US. Well, in fact, to be in the top 50, in fact. But I like Despacito.
Indeed. Lucy, which one would you be choosing? The one with Daddy Yankee or the one with Justin Bieber?
I like the Daddy Yankee one because it reminds me of I lived in Honduras about 10 years ago and reggaeton, which is that.
It's huge
that.
There.
It was massive then. I got really into it and I went to loads of reggaeton concerts and I've always listened to reggaeton. And obviously that's like a cheesy type of reggaeton, but I love the beat. I think it's really fun and it obviously has an enduring power because that beat's been around for a really long time. So,
well, we know what Lucy Jones will be doing in between episodes of House of Cards now, at least. Fernando, thank you very much for running us through the charts today. That indeed brings us to the end of today's program. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Fernando was our researcher, and I'm Ben Rylan. Join us again at the same time next week. But for now, let's not play out on that number one single, as we've heard plenty of times on this program. Instead, we're going to play out on Belgium's number two song this week, City Lights by Blanche. Thanks for listening. All alone in the danger zone. Are you ready to take my hand? All alone in the flame of doubt. Are we going to lose it all? Love came in between.